Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, July 7th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, the keynote address from the National Homebrewers Conference in San Diego, California. Vinny Chalurzo, inventor of the Double IPA and founder of Russian River Brewing Company, takes us on a timeline of his trek from home brewing to one of the world's most innovative professional brewers. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find our Brewer's Logbooks as well to help you log and track 50 batches of beer. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you the show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone and Android podcast apps on their respective stores, and we're on the BlackBerry podcast directory, too. Now, I believe this may be the longest episode of Basic Brewing Radio. Vinny had a lot of history to cover in his keynote, and he did it well, so I want to keep the intro short this week. It seems like forever since I got to speak to you. We had a great June, just awesome. The Homebrewers Conference was incredible, as usual. So much fun to see so many of you guys in person and to spend some time with you and drink some beers and carry on and such. And we appreciate everybody who came up to say howdy. And while we were out there, I challenged you guys. Remember, before we went, I challenged you guys to come up with some experiments that we could play with while we were in San Diego getting together. And we got excellent response. We recorded four experiment-based episodes. And I think you'll really like what we came home with. And we also shot three video episodes while we were out there. So look for those soon on the Basic Brewing video feed as well. And speaking of experiments, the form, the online form for entering your data for the Brew Your Own Magazine Basic Brewing Radio Collaborative Experiment on Dry Yeast Rehydration is out there at basicbrewing.com/experiment. Or you can find the link at the top of the page at basicbrewingradio.com. And by the way, thanks to Kelly Dodson for working to update the back end of the website while we were away to make the form work a bit better and look a bit better. And I hope everybody enjoys that. I hope everything is nailed down on the site. So let me know if you find anything with the form or anywhere else in the site that is giving you any kind of trouble. While we were in San Diego at club night, by the way, we tasted one set of beers from the rehydration experiment, and we recorded that, and you'll be hearing the results of that in a couple of weeks. That's aside. That's in addition to the other four experiments that we did standalone episodes for. So lots of fun. I appreciate it. It just blows me away every time, you know, I get data from somebody doing one of these experiments or is doing something kind of inspired by the experiments. It's just fun to see that kind of spark out there. The deadline for submitting your data is July 15th for the yeast rehydration experiment, so please don't forget. I'm about a month behind on email, so I apologize for that, and I hope to get caught up on that by next week, and I appreciate your patience very much. Now, let's go to San Diego, California, where the American Homebrewers Association director Gary Glass is about to introduce the keynote address.
The reason you're all here, you know, it's a great honor for me to be able to introduce our keynote speaker, Vinny Chalurzo. I've known Vinny and his wife, Natalie, for several years now. And they're two of the nicest people in the beer world that you would ever meet, or any other world for that matter. It's really I find myself very lucky to be able to call them friends. Vinny is truly one of us. He started as a homebrewer in 1989, and opened his first brewery in the Blind Pig in 1994. Most of you likely know Vinny as the brewmaster and owner of Russian River Brewing Company. While he's been a professional craft brewer for many years now, he has never lost the innovative spirit of homebrewing. Vinny was the first to brew a double IPA, and his Pliny the Elder has been voted best beer in America by you, the Zymergy readers, multiple years in a row. He is a leader in experimenting with the use of wild yeast and barrel aging, and he's what one of the few people that I refer to as a magic brewer. No matter what kind of crazy things he seemed to come up with, they all taste fantastic. So please join me in welcoming Vinny Chalurzo.
How's everyone doing? Can you hear me in the back okay? Good. Cheers. The beer is meant to be consumed. Don't hold it. You can toast yourself as much as you want today. So, yeah, it's great to be here. It's a real honor. I want to thank the Brewers Association and the local committee that's put this all together. I'm pretty sure they're setting the standard for future AHA homebrew conferences. It really is amazing to see 2,000 homebrewers. I did the keynote for the Craft Brewers Conference in Austin a few years ago, and I'm not even sure there was 2,000 people there. So, what really amazes me about all you being here, so many of you came from such a long distance, and this is just your hobby, and you spent your vacation time probably and time and money to come here to be a part of this. So my presentation today is just going to be kind of a look back. Some of the locals around here know my background. Many of you don't know how I got started. So you're going to see some old pictures, terrible pictures when the resolution of photography wasn't as good as it is now, so I'll apologize now. Before I get into it, I do want to talk about the three beers real quick. Most of you know Pliny the Elder. That's our double IPA. I think I've sent like half of you the recipe. And the other half, I think we drank a keg together last night. So then the Janet's Brown Ale. The rock star of the homebrew world, Mike McDowell, Tasty. So we love you. We absolutely, Mike is a rock star when he comes into the brewery and brews. So, and then the third beer is Happy Hops, which we were pouring the other two beers last night at the Pro Brewers Night. Happy Hops is a continuation of going into the experimental world, except it's using a new experimental hop variety called 369. And I actually talked to Jason Peralt of Peralt Farms and Select Botanicals a couple days ago to make sure it was cool that I talked about this hop. This is a new hop variety that is moving forward. You're going to taste kind of an apricot, fruity, blueberry, peach, mango character in the beer, and that's coming from the 369 variety. On my bucket list in life is to name a hop, so I'm hoping they go with my name. I contributed a couple names, but I don't think they liked them, though. But anyways, so you guys will see 369 in some form down the line available to brew with. And it's a really unique hop in that it's the daughter to the Simcoe hop, the very popular Simcoe hop. It has none of the similarities of the Simcoe hop. And on its own, we didn't like it. So we actually made a beer with the 369 and Simcoe. So a little bit of the piney citrus quality that you're getting is actually coming from Simcoe. So I want to first acknowledge there's a lot of people that have helped me, inspired me, helped me along the way. First off is Charlie Papazian. Unfortunately, he's not here this week, but the new Complete Joy of Homebrewing was my first brewing book, and I think I read that thing so much that the papers in the binding weren't even connected anymore. Along the way, I was lucky enough to become friends with George Fix before he passed away. George really taught me the technical side of brewing. Fred Eckhart for just his imaginative creativeness and always telling me to think outside the box, and you'll see some of these people pop up through the presentation. Fritz Maytag is a home brewer back in the day and a wannabe pro brewer. Going to Anchor was magical, seeing those cool ships and the Copper Brewery. I'm sure a lot of you have been to Anchor. If you haven't, it's a very cool place. Couple names that you may not know, Jack McAuliffe. Jack was the founder of the New Albion Brewery in Sonoma, just real close to where we're at. If you don't know who Jack is, I highly recommend you Google him and learn about him. Jack was the first brewery to be licensed in America since Prohibition. Fritz took Anchor over as an already licensed brewery. Jack McAuliffe started a little, he was the original Nano Brewery, in fact. His brewery was like one barrel, I think. So, and then getting into some names who you probably know. Electric Dave, that's a name probably most of you don't know, and he'll pop up in my presentation. Yeah, see? There's Bisbee, Arizona's in the house. So. Peter Buchart and Tommy Arthur, specifically on the barrel side of stuff. Tommy's here today, and a dear, dear friend, one of my best friends. Back when Tommy and I were starting doing these barrel beers, Peter was our go-to guy from New Belgium. Finally, Matt Brennelson and John Mallett before we get to the, as I call him, the Yoda, Ken. But when we built our production brewery, I leaned so much on Matt and John. Matt Brennelson from Firestone Walker, John Mallett from Bell's. I don't think we'd have a production brewery without John and Matt and my constant just barrage of questions and emails. And they never once, you know, said, stop, we don't have time. So... Ken Grossman, nothing needs to be said about Ken. He's affected Natalie and I to a point where it's tough to put to words. Going to Sierra Nevada for me is like going to Mecca, and we're very fortunate to become friends with the Grossmans and the whole crew. And then finally, just our brewing team. We've grown to the point where we have five or six people in the brewery, and there's just no way that... it would happen without them. And most important, my amazing wife and my wife and business partner in the brewery. There were some very lean years when we had Blind Pig just north of here in Temecula. One year, my tax return read like $3,200, you know, gross income for the year. And my parents are here today, too, and... some of you remember them from the Southern California Homebrewer Festivals when they were at the winery. But we definitely lived off Natalie's income from the winery that she worked at. And we'd go to my parents' house every Sunday and raid the extra refrigerator that had all the leftovers from the catering they were doing at the winery. So, and now Natalie takes care of everything that is everything other than brewing at the brewery. And leaves me to do the creative part of brewing, and so much of this, of running a brewery, has nothing to do with brewing. So having an amazing wife and partner is makes Russian River roll. So yeah. So what I've done today is I'm just kind of broken it down into my early years of home brewing, then going into the Blind Pig years. You'll see some crazy stuff that you probably never thought a brewery could operate with, like a plastic fermenter, things like that. And then into Russian River and kind of all the different segments that I've gone through with Russian River to current and where we're at now. So I hope you enjoyed. It was a lot of fun. Like I was saying earlier, you guys are all here for fun. This is your hobby. So it's I was just trying to do something fun, give you a little bit of insight of one brewer who who's gone from home brewing to professional. And a little bit of a take on what Ken Grossman did a couple years ago in Oakland. That was a really cool presentation, so I hope you enjoy it. I started home brewing here in San Diego, just 10 miles from here on 67th Street, just a little bit outside of the SDSU area. My roommates, Dennis and Steve, and I started home brewing. I was a member of QAF in 1989, I think it there's people in QAF in the house. So we met at Callahan's, this little brew pub up in Mira Mesa, I guess that is. And it was nothing like it is today. QAF was the only homebrew club down here in the area. The homebrew shop was out in El Cajon, called Beer and Winecraft, I think. Owen and Audrey were an older couple that ran it, and they'd been there forever. I was trying to think of things that were unique to that time period, and the one thing that comes to mind was this hop variety called CFJ90 that they were selling. It was an experimental hop, and then they were also selling this hop called CFJ4. And it turned out that over time, CFJ90 did become a real hop, and that turned into Centennial hop. So the CFJ90 was the actual experimental number, and then CFJ4 never made it. It had some trait that the hop community didn't like. Eventually, Home Brew Mart opened, and I started buying some ingredients from them, from Yusuf and Jack, and. Their vials of liquid yeast that they were selling that were pitchable quantity from Chris White, and Chris was going to school to like get DNA toxicology or something crazy like that. I don't know what it was, but I was buying these pitchable quantities, and the Y yeast smack packs were available at the time. But a pitchable quantity, being able to buy it and just brew with it at any time was a pretty magical thing. And you'll hear me talk about Chris a little bit more. While I was brewing here in San Diego with my roommates Dennis and Steve, we even had a name. We called ourselves the Danger Brothers. Our slogan was, if we won't drink it, we don't expect you to. And some of that stuff was pretty bad. So. If in it for the locals, you may know Dennis from Hamilton's, and so we did a beer with cactus prickly pears. This was way ahead of Sam Calagione. Sam had nothing on us, And if you ever hear me talk before, you know I like to throw Sam under the bus as much as I can. So, and I don't think he's here. My parents were famous for growing Petit Sirah at their vineyard and winery, so we made a Petit Sirah beer, grape beer. And then the funny one is the Valdez celebration. We happened to be homebrewing the night of the Valdez oil spill. We happened to be making a espresso stout beer, and we used so much that there was an oil slick on the neck of the bottle. So. It was actually very appropriate that of the timing of it. So, for some of the locals, you'll recognize this. That's Holiday Wine Cellar in Escondido, just kind of spitting distance from the amazing Stone Bistro and Brewery. Back then, although access to market can always be improved for small breweries, back then living in Temecula, I'd left. San Diego, took a trip to Europe for 8 or 10 weeks, and then moved back to Temecula to help my parents at their winery. And you couldn't buy good beer in Temecula. Temecula is about an hour's drive north up here, up the 15, little inland, for those of you outside the area. Eventually we could get Sam Adams and Sierra Nevada in the local market. But until then, we had to drive to Escondido every so often and load the old Hyundai up with beer and move on. So it's a real kind of tribute to what's happened in our industry these days, and a lot of it has to do with you guys buying the beer. So I'd make a Christmas beer every year. That one was actually drawn by Natalie. We'd give it out as gifts, kind of cutesy stuff. While I was homebrewing, a gentleman from the Maltose Falcons beer club up in L.A., I believe it was, someone can correct me if it's wrong, was it Gerald Stoker? Is that? Yeah. Yep. All right. Cool. So he calls me and says, I understand you're a home brewer. And I said, yes, I am. Not that good at it, but nonetheless still a home brewer. And he asked if I wanted to be a part of starting the Southern California Homebrewers Festival. And really what he was asking is if I would ask my parents if it was okay if we threw a party on the winery property. And so for those Southern California homebrewers that went those first 5 years, you know that it was like the Woodstock of beer festivals. And so my parents said, cool, let's do it. And I think the first year we were expecting 50 people, and like 200 showed up. So already you could see the love of homebrewing in Southern California. My fondest memory of that was meeting George and Lori Fix. I still believe that the Southern California Homebrewers Festival wouldn't be what it is now without George and Lori coming out. They came out that first year on their own dime. Our little 8 or 10 people community of brewers that started this thing, we didn't have any money. I think the winery even fronted some of the money for tents and that sort of thing. So George gave us some validity, and after that, we had enough money in the coffer to at least fly the speakers out. And so that lasted for about 2 years at about 5 years at my parents' winery, and then we just ran out of space, I think, at 1,000 or 800 people. So that's Fred Eckhart, as you all know. I love Fred. He's one of my favorite people. Fred was homebrewing sake in 1968. I wasn't even born yet, you know. And we were, anyone in this room that was homebrewing back then was just thinking about beer. He was already on the sake. He had already conquered beer. I remember at the first homebrew fest that he came to at the winery at the Southern California Homebrewers Festival, he forgot his hat. And Fred's a little balding on the top. He always has been. And so he asked my dad if he could borrow a hat. And my dad used to be a television lighting director, so he's worked with, Frank Sinatra, Soupy Sales, all these people. And so my dad brought out like 3 hats to choose from. And my dad was like, well, this was worn by Soupy Sales. This was worn by Frank Sinatra. So every year after that, Fred forgot his hat on purpose because he always wanted to borrow a hat and hear the story. And then always at the end of the night, he would sit down with my parents in the house and have a glass of wine. So during my homebrew years, a local homebrewer in Temecula, who eventually became my assistant brewer at Blind Pig and did all of our carpentry work, Bill Bird, knew this guy in Bisbee, Arizona, Electric Dave. Electric Dave was the first small brewery to open in Arizona since Prohibition. He had this little brewery building that's on there. Everything in Bisbee is on barter. Of course, Dave had some other stuff to barter as well beyond his electrical skills, but there was a neon guy that did pretty cool neon work. So Bill took me to Bisbee and saw Electric Dave, met him. That's Dave and I brewing a batch of beer. So that was literally my first ever commercial batch of beer. As a home brewer, you could imagine what it was like. I remember hearing Ken Grossman talk about Jack McAuliffe and Jack being such an inspiration and giving him that can-do spirit. That to do it on a shoestring and on a budget, and that was the same. That was Electric Dave was to me, and I still keep in touch with Dave. I think he's brewing again in Bisbee, but he built this brewery on a shoestring, and eventually it closed. And I bought the equipment from him to start Blind Pig. So this trip was very fortuitous that I met Dave and eventually bought his equipment, which led into Blind Pig. I knew that on the first time I brewed, I wanted to do this professionally as a job, even as crappy as my first brews were. But in time, they got better, and Blind Pig eventually came to be. That was an early kind of mono drawing, if you will, of the logo. And so as I got more serious about wanting to go professional, my home brews became more geared towards equipment that could brew, on a professional scale. I knew that I wanted to make IPAs, but I also knew that they probably wouldn't sell. They couldn't be a primary seller, so we made a golden ale as well. And those were the two beers that we made at Blind Pig. And I also knew that there's no way that I'd be buying this super nice, you know, brew house. So I geared everything on a single temperature infusion mash, very simplistic stuff, and stuff that you really don't need to go beyond for these type of ales. That was us picking up the equipment from Bisbee, Arizona. Dave wasn't around at the time, unfortunately, but few of you can laugh and know what I mean. Inside joke. But that was a local homebrew club, or at least part of it. They were the Suds of the Pioneer. That was the name of their the homebrew club. And it was all dudes. It was a little bit, you know, sexist and stuff that only the guys were in the homebrew club. But the women, the wives and girlfriends had an auxiliary, and they called themselves the Bubbles. So you had the Suds of the Pioneers and the Bubbles in Bisbee, Arizona. And if you've ever been to Bisbee, it's an old mining town. And then Dave was in South Bisbee. That just meant you drove through this giant corrugated drain pipe, and you ended up in South Bisbee, which is where his brewery was. So we brought the equipment back to Temecula. That's Bill and Dave. We were digging a hole, what looks like, to our neighbor's suite on the other side. It was, I think, 1,000-square-foot building or warehouse on Avenida Alvarado in Temecula. We did the whole brewery for $160,000, and probably when we opened, didn't have anything left in the bank. The equipment was a 7-barrel system that we bought from Dave. You'll notice my love for a Sierra Nevada started early. On the left side of the picture is a 6-pack of Sierra Nevada that we were drinking during the construction. We couldn't afford a backhoe, so we dug the whole trench drain by hand. And we couldn't afford to cut all the concrete out, so all we did was run a trench drain down the middle, and everything from the sides was still flat concrete, so we had to squeegee everything to that point if you spilled. So you would always run a hose to the trench drain. And at that, it wasn't a long trench drain all the way down. It was just every so often there was a little square drain set in, if I remember correctly. So there's some more pictures. You'll notice there's a pallet of bricks sitting kind of in the foreground of the kettle and mash tun. The kettle was straight back. That's the one that's missing the door. The mash tun was on the right. And in Bisbee, Arizona, there's no municipality there that was watching over Dave that said you have to plummet this way, electrical code, even though he was an electrician. So he had all these heating elements from the bottom of multiple hot water heaters plumbed together, and that's how he heated the 7-barrel kettle. The kettle came from a military base nearby. I can't remember the town, but nearby Bisbee, Arizona. It was an old soup kettle that they would make like 500 gallons of soup in for this military base. So we had to, you know, in the being able to be very crafty and MacGyver-like kind of came early on in the industry for me, not having any money. So we did invest in a real nice kind of what I call a you know, direct fire gas burner flamethrower, and we built a little fireplace on the bottom of the kettle, and that was the picture. And I don't even know why we took these pictures back in the day, but I'm glad I have them now. So for any of you that are thinking about going professional, take pictures of everything, because you never know when you're going to be asked to give the keynote at the Homebrewers Conference. So, but that was literally the bottom of the kettle. We just took fire bricks and built a little fireplace on the inside, and then we you know, I think where we took the picture from was where the kind of the flamethrower burner jetted in, and then we quickly put the skirt around it, so when the city came to do the inspection, they couldn't get in and actually see how janky it was on the underside of the kettle where the burner was. No, we had a little tasting room that was the office. I'm not even sure at the time where Dave, my business partner's office was, because eventually we took over another suite and had a real office. But we were very fortunate to have a very good logo, and at one point 25% of our sales were were merchandise. That probably kept us in business a little longer than if we would have had a not so good logo. So we had fun with the logo. We had the Christmas pig, the 4th of July pig. So there was a local baseball class A team up in Lake Elsinore. They're still there. And so we made a beer for them. They were Lake Elsinore Storm. And then the two teams in Riverside and San Bernardino, just farther north of Temecula, wanted beer, the Mavericks and the Quakes. So we did beers for them with a logo. And not that we made lagers, but the Oktoberfest pig. So now our artist was just having fun. Dave, my business partner, was into running, I think, so we had the athletic pig. And then finally my favorite, the Rambo pig. It's like the Brewing Network people, you know, all with the grenades and stuff. So, but anyways, there was fun to do different merchandise, and the merchandise really did keep us in business. I had this little mill. I couldn't find this picture, and I had to go through a box of stuff at home, and I found it, because that mill would do like 50 or 100 pounds an hour. It was so slow, and I mean, it would take you like hours to mill a 7-barrel batch of a beer. And we would mill into trash cans, like food grade trash cans. We'd drag them over into the brewery. And that picture shows that stand with a beat up pallet on it. And we would lift the trash cans one at a time up onto that stand, and then lift dump the trash cans in. So it'd always take two people to mash in at Blind Pig. And something Dr. Lewis said to me once in a class, or taught in a class at Davis that I was at, just like a weekend class, was that you should be able to brew with you and your dog. And someone said, well, why is that? And he goes, well, the dog's just going to lay there and, you know, not going to do anything. So you need to be able to do it on your own. So we broke that rule right from MASH to start with. But again, you know, when you're doing this sort of thing, you have to have a lot of, you know, craftiness and figure out ways to do it on the cheap. And that's exactly what we did. And Here was the first mash with Dave and I mashing in. You can see we're standing on that stand, dumping them in. There's Natalie probably mixing the grain in after the fact or something. Still the first brew day. Again, take pictures of all these first stuff if you guys are going pro, because it's cool to look back. That's actually the recipe. You can't see it. And like Ken Grossman said about the first recipe of pale ale he showed a couple years ago, he left a couple key things out, like his grandma's chocolate chip recipe, you know, cookie recipe or whatever. But that literally was the first beer we brewed. It was the double IPA. We called it inaugural ale. And I'm really glad that I had that. It was a lot of fun thumbing through some old files and finding the recipe for it. I think it was Chinook Cascade and Centennial. CTZ didn't even, Columbus Tomahawk Zeus didn't even exist back then. So there's, you know, even when I started, a lot of these new varieties weren't in existence. In fact, there was more old school varieties like Bullion, Brewer's Gold, Bromling Cross, things that some of you have never even heard of. You're like, what's that? It's like 8-track, you know? So the mash tun was on a swivel at Blind Pig, so you could empty it out. So you dump it into trash cans, which is what Natalie's doing there. I remember one day it was the Balloon and Wine Festival in Temecula, and I was there brewing on a Saturday by myself, and you would, to stand up there, you would like grab the mash tun and put your foot on the crossbar that's behind the trash can there, and you would get yourself up to do whatever you needed to do. And there's a pin that sticks in on the side that locks it, and the pin wasn't in all the way. So I went up and grabbed it and dumped 500 pounds of malt, of 150-some degree malt and water, just all over the brewery. Luckily, I was wearing pants that day, down my boots, just covered the entire brewery. I remember our friend Natalie, my friends were there, and Jason and Michelle, and I let out the biggest F-bomb that I've probably ever let out, and they quickly left, and I cleaned up when I went home for the day and probably just drank the 500, my sorrows of 500 pounds of malt away. Now, at that time, I mentioned Chris White getting yeast from White Labs through Home Brew Mart, through Yusuf and Jack, getting a little vial. So I contacted Chris, and I said, well, you know, I'm starting this little brewery. I'd like to buy yeast from you. And he was already selling yeast to Pizza Port. At the time, they only had their original location in Solana Beach. And then he was selling the vials to Home Brew Mart. Ballast Point didn't exist yet for Home Brew Mart like it does today. And so we were Chris's third customer, and it was back before cell phones were, you know, unless you had that big giant type that so I would call Chris a couple weeks ahead and tell him I would need yeast. At the time, I think there was only one yeast. It was it's why California Ale yeast is 001 or whatever. It's the number one because it was his first yeast. And that's what we were using, and that's what I think that was the only thing he was selling at the time. Maybe he had a couple more choices for the homebrewers. But so he'd call me a couple weeks later, and he was doing all this out of the biology lab at University of UCSD in La Jolla, and his professor must have been very very cool with him doing all this on the side while he got his degree in DNA toxicology or whatever it was. So I would drive to La Jolla, and there was a mobile gas station on the corner, and I would call him, and it must have looked like a drug deal going down. Because I would, so then he would answer the phone in the lab, and then I'd drive up the hill, and he'd walk out, and he'd hand me a brown bag full of yeast, and I would give him a wad of cash, and it was just like rolled, you know, a wad of cash. I'd take the bag, shove it in an ice chest, and within 10 seconds I would drive off, and that was it. He was too busy with his studies, and I needed to get back to the brewery to work. So, anyways, when it came time to for Chris to figure out what he wanted to do, I remember him asking Jack and Yusuf and Gina and Vince from Pizza Port and myself, like, what should I do? And we're like, dude, you need to, you know, go into brewing. This pitchable quantity thing is, and it's changed, you know, the beer industry with the pitchable quantity. So it's kind of cool that it happened here in San Diego. So that's the first filtration, first beer coming out of the filter. Those are Grundy tanks. You don't see them as much anymore. I think we had every conceivable type of Grundy tank. Those were the ones in the background are forkliftable Grundy tanks. We had them with top entry, side entry. Side entry with like 100 bolts, you know, some with 10 giant bolts, some with giant clamps on the top. They were just a hodgepodge of tanks that we got from Electric Dave, and they always seemed to leak. So but any brewer in here that's ever worked at a brewery with Grundy's, you know that's inevitable, that Grundy's always leak. So we only started out kegging at Blind Pig, but eventually we did get into bottling. So we labeled by hand first with that's called a Pot Devin labeler, and eventually we bought an actual inline labeler that I think we bought from Great Divide Brewery used, and we would put them back in the case initially, but eventually we built this little chute. If you look onto the right side of that picture, there's a little chute going down on the outside of the wall. You can see we didn't even finish on the painting the wall. I think we probably ran out of money or something. And the bottles would go down that chute, and then we'd set them in on the machine, and they would get bottled, and off we would go. This is when we took over a second warehouse. You know, our two or three biggest issues with Blind Pig was, one, we were too small. A seven-barrel system just wasn't going to do it for a production brewery. Two, we were undercapitalized, and it's probably the, you know, problem with most small businesses, no matter what it is. And we probably shouldn't have done six packs to begin with. Going to 22-ounce bombers to start with probably would have been a much smarter way to go. That's a Bill delivering our first case of beer to Old Town Liquor in Temecula. Again, why we took pictures of that, I don't know, but I'm glad we have them. So we eventually needed more tanks. The plastic fermenters weren't enough, so we bought this 3,000-gallon wine tank that didn't hold pressure, obviously. Wine tanks don't hold pressure. So I would start brewing at 4 in the morning, and I think we could do 3 brews a day, and then Bill would come in about 6 at night and brew till 4 in the morning, and I would come back. I think we'd put like 10 batches of beer into that giant until we just brewed until we got 10 batches done, or until beer was spilling out the top, and that was it. That's how Bill and I did it for a while, but 100 hour weeks for even more than that were wearing on me quickly. We did eventually get a silo. Back in the day, I would drive up to LA every Wednesday at Great Western Malting in Los Angeles. Was like you could come and pick up malt direct, whether you were a professional brewer or even a home brewer. They had these 200-gallon drums that they would fill or whatever size. So I would drive up there every Wednesday or every couple Wednesdays and pick up malt. And it was cheaper to buy the malt in bulk like that than buying it in bags. And, of course, I never took into account, like, the 3 hours of traffic both ways and what my time was worth. But it seemed like, at the time, the right thing. But we did eventually get a silo. We would put grain out. We'd pull grain out of the silo through that white PVC pipe going into the trash can, and then we'd haul that over, lift it up, dump it in to the mill. The mill would then fill other trash cans. We would then take the trash cans inside. I think we handled the malt, like, 6 times before, and then getting rid of it, we dumped it out, took it outside, had to lift it up on a platform. We didn't have a forklift. Thank God, eventually, an automotive guy came in next door eventually, and he had a forklift so we could borrow it. We had some fun though. We had our own marching band. That was a life-size bottle of beer that we, you know, like paper mache or something. You can see the 6-pack. People, we take the slip sheets from the bolt glass that we got on occasion, and you can see them wearing the 6-packs, and they would wear the pig snout noses and the goggles and stuff, and everyone played kazoos for some reason. So one year, they had these in Temecula for 4th of July and then Christmas. One of the Christmas parades, so we decorated one of our delivery trucks with lights, and obviously we needed a generator to run it, and we were in the very back of the queue of the line. It was a very popular thing in Temecula to be in the local parade. So there was no open container law in Temecula at the time either, so we were drinking a bunch of beer while we waited, and our generator ran out of gas because the wait was so long. So we had some of those beer in the box bladders, probably not the best thing to take to the gas station and fill with gas, but we did. So we brought it back to the float, and the gas station wasn't too far. We didn't have a funnel. Of course, we'd been drinking, so no one thought to ask for one of those oil funnels at the gas station. And so we poured some gas in. Someone fired it up while we were pouring gas in. Not the smartest thing. Eventually, the gas spilled everywhere, and we caught the generator on fire. And so here's our float, and we were tugging this generator. It was on fire, and thank God the fire department was right behind us in the line on the parade, and they came over with their fire extinguisher, and they were like, maybe you guys shouldn't drink anymore. And in time though, the long hours got to me, and Natalie and I decided to sell our part in Blind Pig. My old business partner found a friend, and they bought my part out, and they kept Blind Pig going for a few more years. Did some contract brewing, but we moved up to Northern California. No job in line, nowhere to live. I think we put everything in storage and moved in with a friend of ours for a while until we could find a place. But Corbell Winery was opening a brewery, and at the time there was a few breweries getting into beer. And Corbell happened to be one of them. And so that was in 1997 that they opened a brewery. So they hired me to put the brewery in and put it together. So that was Corbell. It was the brandy tower outside the brewery. The building itself, the brewery was actually in one of the oldest buildings on the property. It was really cool. Wall-to-wall tile, and the floors were tile. I'm surprised the ceiling wasn't tile. Those were the tanks coming in. It was a 15-barrel brew house. Yeah, it's just venting, yeah. So there, There we were moving these tanks in. I'd never imagined moving tanks in with a crane. We'd always done it by hand and tilted them up. So that started my friendship with Precision Crane. That was them after installation. It was all clad, copper-clad brewery. It was, you can imagine, you know, how it was coming from Blind Pig. So, you know, going to this from that, you know, plastic fermenters and all was an eye-opener. I threw this in for no reason because working at Corbell did have its challenges. That was actually my drive to work every winter. The road would literally flood. That was the vineyard next to it that would flood like that every year. So we grew hops at Corbell in Sonoma County. It's actually a county ordinance that if you have a small, if you have a brewery in an unincorporated agricultural area, you need to grow something, just like a winery has to grow grapes. So we grew hops. And so the first couple years, we picked the hops and dried them, sun-dried them. And in fact, if any of you are growing hops and you are, you know, you're not going to make a wet hop beer, sun-drying hops are the way to go because it does it at such a lower temperature than a homemade kiln would, and it just retains so much more of the oil. So we sun-dried the hops for a couple years, but at the GABF in 1998, I tasted Sierra Nevada's first harvest beer, which was made using all wet hops. And at the same time, a hop broker, Gerard Lemons, gave me a little insight on making wet hop beers. I got in contact with Steve Dressler at Sierra Nevada, and Steve taught me the ways of brewing a wet hop beer. And so each year, that was us back when we were picking the hops by hand. But later on, we would just pluck them up by the hop yard. A good hop picker could pick 3 pounds an hour. And so we'd bring all of our friends in, or sometimes the vineyard crew to help us pick the hops to do the wet hop beer. At Corbell, at Russian River, we started bottling. That was our little filler. If you can imagine, it was a little 2 or 3 head filler. And it could do like 2 or 3 bottles a minute. It was very slow. It couldn't cap on foam, which I knew was very critical. So we kind of MacGyvered this little tiny tubing to a little keg there. It was blasting CO2 out, and you'd put the bottle underneath it. And somehow you'd rouse the beer on top. It would foam. Sometimes you'd be banging it on the ground to get it to foam up. And we literally just used a hand capper to do it. But in time, we went to a Maheen, and we were on our way into bottling at Corbell. You know, Corbell was a big company, they're the largest sparkling wine maker in America. They make a ton of brandy, and they own several other wineries. So they were they bought a new winery, or an old winery, and ripped the old building down and built a new one in Lake Sonoma, and wanted to put a brewery up there as well. So I had the opportunity to be involved with literally putting a brewery together from scratch, brand new building. It was a little 10-barrel system that we had made by a local company. So again, Precision Crane helping us move the tanks in. And this was a really amazing facility that was a winery and a brewery and a catering facility. That's what it looked like inside. Again, floor tile, wall tile, everything was done just perfect. And then somewhere in there, probably what ultimately is, you know, aside from Corbell eventually selling Natalie and I the brewery, but probably second to that was us coming up with Pliny the Elder. It really has changed the direction of our brewery. And that was the first brew log of it. It was kind of cool that I had that sitting around, too. That was about 2001. And there's a great little beer bar in Hayward, which is just a little bit out of the way from Oakland, called The Bistro. And Vic and Cynthia, the owners, put on these great festivals each year, an IPA festival, a double IPA festival, a couple others. So at the first double IPA festival that he was putting on a few months before, Vic called a few of the local breweries, Berry Public, Marin, Moylan's, ourselves. And that was really the beginning of the resurgence of the double IPA. We had done one, you know, at Blind Pig. Rogue had done one. Stone had done some stuff. But it was really Vic calling some breweries and saying, you know, I'm doing this festival. I want you guys to make Imperial double IPAs. And that first year, there was like 5 or 6 of them made. And you know, I think it was ourselves, Stone, Rogue, Marin, maybe Moylan's, and Bear Republic. I think that was it. And it was a tiny little festival, and that's when we eventually made Pliny the Elder. We were looking for a name that something. First, we were thinking of something big, you know, big flavor, that sort of thing. We came up with a couple things, but nothing was really good. And then we started thinking of like large format wine bottles that are, you know, named after gods like Methuselah, Nebuchadnezzar, that sort of thing. And we still didn't. That was cool. That probably would have worked, but it wasn't quite what we wanted. So we were really going for something that would hopefully eventually kind of create a personality of its own, and which Pliny obviously has. But we started looking through our beer dictionary at hops, and hops referred to Humulus lupulus, the botanical name, and then that referred to Lupus salictarius, the original botanical name, and then that referred us to Pliny the Elder, and we just knew it instantly, like, there's a name. But we never pushed it. The growth of the beer kind of happened organically. While we were making it Corbel, I think we made it like maybe once, twice a year. It wasn't something that really became a full-time beer until we started to, or moved the brewery to Santa Rosa for the brew pub. So in 2002, Corbel decided to get out of the beer, or they started thinking about getting out of the beer business. It was actually on April Fool's Day that my boss, Harold Duncan, told me that they were closing the brewery. And I said to him, like, you know, really? And he was like, no, we are. I'm like, yeah, but it's April Fool's Day, you know. You got to, it was true. So in 2002, they told me, you have a year to wind things down. What do you want? I was actually offered a winemaking job at the winery. Corbel had just bought Kenwood. The current winemaker was eventually going to move up and do bigger things for the company. But I wanted to continue on with beer. So I worked out with Harold that I, you know, wanted to somehow get the name, all the beer names, so the Russian River name, all the beer names. And then I threw the hop yard in just for shits and giggles, and they threw that in too. So we got that's what I walked with. I walked in lieu of Severance, I walked with a brand name, and probably most important, the brand that had already been in existence for 6 years in Sonoma County. So, you know, it's you often don't see the little company or the big company help the little guy, and in this case, you know, it's hard to put in words how much Corbel did for us to help Russian River keep it going, because they could have easily just kept the brand. They had offers to buy it for much more from other breweries, regional breweries that would do different contract brews that wanted to buy it. So we were very fortunate. And still to this day, if you ever go to the Corbel Winery in their deli, all four taps are all Russian River beer. So from here, we got into construction again. You know, it was like going from Beverly Hills to the slums, though, because I was working for Corbel. Not that money wasn't an object, but they had money, and it was a very solid company. So we found the building in downtown Santa Rosa, gutted it. Not that good of a picture, but it gives you an idea of what we were up against to make the brewery, you know, move on and have a transition. So you always come across some angels when you're doing these brewery projects. Anyone that's done it will tell you that. We had this guy, he was Dan something or other demolition, and we started doing the demolition ourselves of this building in downtown Santa Rosa, and we got through the first wall, and there was another false ceiling there. And I was like, Jesus Christ, this isn't going to be good. So we cut a hole, and we saw another one. And then we got up on a ladder, and we cut a hole, and there was another one. There was like three or four false ceilings. So like every time the business had changed, they just put a new false ceiling in. So we decided that 7,100 square feet of demolition on our own was not going to happen. So we hired Dan Davis Demolition, I think is what it was. And it was $20,000 that we didn't expect to pay, but he let us defer 100% of the payment until we had opened. And again, you meet these angels through these projects, and you don't know why. I still can't tell you why Dan did it. I asked him once, and he goes, you guys just seem like nice people. And so we didn't pay him till like 6 months after we were opened. Of course, we gave him like gift cards, you know, like as interest. So there we were laying concrete at the pub. We finally got the concrete in, moving tanks in. Again, we meet Precision Crane. The tanks are actually too tall. We bought a used brewery, so we sold the brewery at Corbell. We bought a used brewery out of a defunct brewery in North Carolina. And at the time, they had the 6% law in North Carolina. So the tanks were all, and the brew house was all a little bit small for what we wanted to do. So ultimately, it's more like an 18-barrel system for what we're using it for. Tanks were too tall to move in the door, so we brought them in on their side. There was skylights, still are, or were places for skylights where we drilled a hole through. The crane would drop its line through, and that's where we tipped them up and then eventually rolled them into place. So right above, that's how it's being tipped up. It's kind of a deceiving picture. Another one getting in. Once we got all the tanks in, we started cleaning them, even while we were in construction, we realized that one of the welds on the CIP was broken on the top. We probably broke it moving it in. We didn't have any money to hire Precision Crane again. Luckily, Bud, the old man, he's now retired and his sons run it. Bud came back on a Sunday with one of the cranes. He and I tipped the tank back down. We got it re-welded and fixed and then put it back in place, and he never charged us for it again. Another one of those moments where you meet, you know, someone who just believed in your project, and we were able to move forward. So we finally got open. There's the front. Many of you have probably been to the pub. We opened on April 3rd, 2004. So we literally had no beer on the market for an entire year. From 2003 into 2004, we had no beer on the market. We took a different approach. You know how when you walk by a storefront and the store is under construction, they block it off. We left it open. We wanted people to see what was going on. We opened with $6,000 in the bank, 3 months late on rent. And our first payroll was almost due because we had the employees, you know, already there to get them trained. But luckily, we opened. It was busy, and we really haven't looked back since. But you know, those first years of Russian River were pretty lean as well. That's the brewery at 4th Street at the brew pub in the back. We kind of quickly outgrew that. And had to make a big decision on what we wanted to do. We opened our brew pub with all investors, no debt, no bank debt. So we literally didn't have a loan that we had to make. We have our structure set up in such a way that we weren't making payments to our investors at the time. But we did decide to move on and do a production brewery. So I got back in the job supervision of a construction site again, which seems to be what a lot of brewers do. You know, brewing, you think it's all, you know, ingredients and hops and this and that, but, you know, as you're moving on and your company continues to grow, so much of it isn't brewing at all. It's all the other things that go along with it. So we got a 11,000 square foot building with it that also has another 7,000 square foot outside. It was just a shell of a warehouse. And ironically, the owner of this building, which we'll eventually buy, used to own a little brewery in Healdsburg. So he actually knew exactly what went into making a brewery go. It was a 50-barrel brew house that we bought from Dogfish Head Brewery. Sam and Mariah were expanding up and putting in a 100-barrel. I'm not sure we would have ever been able to get the production brewery open without Sam and Mariah's generosity, as you know, albeit all the crap that I give Sam. So we bought the brew house used from Dogfish, but all the fermenters came new. We knew that we wanted standardized fermenters. We wanted all of them to be the same shape. We didn't want it to be janky with one, you know, being 75 barrels and one that's 120 barrels that we bought off the used market. So we focused a lot of our money on having unified fermenters. And as we've grown, we've added tanks that still have that same you know, kind of shape to them, so that we're you know, anywhere we brew a beer, we're going to have consistency. So there we are moving the tanks in at Ferdinand Court at the production brewery. That's a 200-barrel Bright tank. We only put 100-barrel fermenters in, but we knew we were going to be putting 200-barrel fermenters in down the line. So we put 200-barrel Bright tanks in right from the get-go, and they're the farthest in, so there was no going back. There's no way to get the 200-barrel Bright tanks out without bringing the 100-barrel tanks out. So we spent the extra money to go big. Again, just some more tanks going in, a hot liquor tank up on the upper left, the kettle, and on the right, one of the fermenters. So In fact, the crane operator was in putting a new tank in a while ago, and he goes, "See that dent up there? I didn't know it was there." He goes, "That was me putting one of those in, but no one saw it the first time." So it was like his kiss mark on the rafters. So we finally opened the production brewery in May of 2008, there on the left is the brew house. I think that's Al, one of our brewers back there doing something. On the right, that's our fermenter one and Bright Beer Tank 1. Those are actually now 100% dedicated to funky beers. If you would have told me, 5 years ago that we would have 100-barrel fermenters and Bright Tanks only dedicated to funky, sour, barrel-aged Brett beers, I would have thought you were crazy. But judging by the line and how much sour beer you guys were drinking last night, I believe it now. From here, just another picture of our cellar, that was original, old bottling line. We've since put a new line in, new fermenters, yeast brinks, and one of the biggest challenges of these big tanks is how to dry hop, and almost every one of our beers are dry hopped, so we researched, and it can be done in a multitude of ways, but we chose to go with the hop cannon method, and we took that idea from Dogfish Head, and it just goes to prove that there's probably no original ideas, because I think they took it from Goose Island. And we basically load the hops in, and all of our fermenters at the big brewery have a CIP arm and then a blow-off arm during fermentation, and that blow-off arm just goes to the top of the tank. So we shoot the hops in through the blow-off arm. They go up. It's kind of like the old days at Costco where they would send the money over into the office and it would shoot through. It's kind of like that, and it kind of sounds like it too. So now that system's been adopted by several breweries in the U.S. We chose to go with a centrifugation right from the get-go. So that's the centrifuge. I think at the time we were the smallest brewery to have a centrifuge, to be making 6,000 barrels a year and using it. But we liked the ability of doing that. We thought it was actually better for the beers. And once we learned how to use it, it really has been. And it's been a great great way to get more beer out of a tank. So a lab is there's a huge difference between doing a brew pub and a production brewery where you're going to be bottling beer and kegging beer and putting it out on the trade, particularly the bottled beer. And so a lab really becomes a critical part of the operation. So this last year to 18 months, we've put a real focus into our lab. That's Mike in there doing something. Our camera at the brewery is stuck on 2004 for some reason. So you'll see some later pictures here that keep saying 2004. But it's the backbone of a production brewery operation. Mike really dictates how things go. If the dissolved oxygen is too high and this, that, or the other thing, we'll shut production down, figure out, where we're getting it from, fix it, bring it back up. The lab really is such an important part of a production brewery operation. That's what it looks like today. There's a few more tanks in there. We've got two yeast brinks, one for our Belgian yeast, one for the California ale yeast. Our new bottling line that we've had now for about a year and a half. Again, for some of you that want to go professional, there's so many breweries put so much focus on the brew house, and they spend so much money on the brew house, and then it comes to bottling, and it sort of becomes a secondary decision. We've always looked at it the other way, and as quick as we could get out of our first bottling line, we bought a new state-of-the-art line, and it really has changed the shelf life and the quality of our beers like you can't believe. So put your money on bottling equipment and less on the brew house. You'll reap much better rewards down the line, particularly if you're making hoppy beers like we're doing and like so many breweries down here are doing and in California. It's so critical. So obviously I can't do a presentation without talking about barrel beers. It's a center point of our operation along with Pliny the Elder. We do primarily make three barrel beers: Temptation, which is in Chardonnay barrels; Supplication, which is in Pinot barrels; and then Consecration, which is in Cabernet barrels. That's a picture of our first barrel room from the front, from the brew pub side of it. That barrel room holds about 50 wine barrels. That's our second barrel room. That's at the production brewery. That holds about 450 wine barrels. And then our newest barrel room that we literally just got licensed about 2 weeks ago from the TTB, from the federal government, the new one holds about 100 wine barrels, and we just finished filling it just before Natalie and I came down. So we're at about 600 wine barrels. They're all wine barrels, no bourbon, no whiskey, no anything like that. We really focus on what we can get locally from the regional wineries in our area. Obviously, we're in the middle of wine country. There's like 600 and more plus wineries within a 30 or 40 mile radius of us. So getting wine barrels isn't that difficult, and a lot of the winemakers hang out at the brewery. So this is a kind of a funny story. We started trying to do spontaneous fermentation after a trip I took to Belgium with a few friends, and a couple of the lambic brewers, we went to three lambic breweries on that trip, but two of them said it can't be done in America. But the Van Roy family at Cantillon were just absolutely in just the opposite. They said it can be done. It may not taste like it does here, but you can do it. So on the flight back, Tommy Arthur and I were dreaming up different ways of doing it. Tommy had this idea to use your mash tun as a horny tank, as they call it in Belgium. So we did a sour mash. We do a sour mash on a Friday night, let it sit overnight. We run off to the kettle. We then pull the grain out, the spent grain out, rinse the mash tun out with cold water, do a regular boil, like in lambic beer, we use aged hops. And then instead of going to a tank, we actually heat exchange back to the mash tun. And you know, if any of you have been to get your food handler's card, if you work at a restaurant or something, they tell you like there's that critical temperature where food goes bad. It's like the red zone or whatever. I thought, well, perfect. If food goes bad there, that's the temperature we want to be at. So we went to the mash tun at like 90 degrees or something, and that's how it happened. That's the top. It actually was fermenting in the mash tun the next morning. So it was a little too warm, but it has shaped our spontaneous fermentation. The barrel was actually fermenting afterwards. You do have to use a lot of ingenuity. Two of our three main barrel beers are fruit beers. So the Consecration gets currants, the Supplication gets cherries. We get them in big 25, 30-pound blocks, and they literally are blocks. So we're trying to figure out a way to break them apart. So we came up with a cement mixer. So we went down to Home Depot and bought a cement mixer. And so we dropped 30-pound blocks of dried fruit. And we only use dried fruit. It's just a personal preference. If we were using fresh fruit, you could just dump it in easy. And then we just add them in by hand, as you can see there. So that's fill-in barrels. Emptying barrels, again, we have a whole system where we drill a 7/64-inch hole for a nail. That's our sample hole. And then there's a 15/16 OD hole on the head of the barrel down at like 6 o'clock where we can pull the cork out and jam a tube in. And then it goes into a strainer. From the strainer, it gets pumped to a tank. And as we've grown brewing, I do less and less brewing. We do have a little R&D homebrew system you'll see in a minute. The one thing I haven't given up is the barrel program. That's my child. I still love to do it. I love doing the blends of it. But it's a critical decision that a brewery owner has to make in time that they'll probably inevitably not be brewing. And again, for some of you that are thinking about going pro, it's a hard decision that you need to make over time. Because if you want to keep being the brewer, you probably won't grow too much. But at the same token, brewing's a young person's sport, and I have a bad back to show for it, as probably most brewers do. So it's not bad bringing in some fresh blood to help out. And you know, some of our brewers have shaped our operation with things that they brought to the table. So that is our brewing team: Mike, Guy, Al, Eric, Kevin, and James. I wouldn't be able to do what I do without them. And having a cohesive group. I'll tell them you applauded. So having a cohesive group that can work together where everyone gets along. You know, some of these guys get together for darts every Friday night. A couple of them have kids, you know, get together. That is so critical and has gone so far with our positive operation and having a just people that get along, and it makes it so easy. So I wanted to show this picture. since Tasty's in the house, so that's we don't do a lot of collaborations. I think we've done four total. We did one with we do one with Avery every year, collaboration, not litigation. We did a really cool sour beer with some of our friends, Isabella Proximus, that we actually brewed at Lost Abbey. We did a kind of a fun beer with an Italian brewer friend of ours, Agostino from Birrificio Italiano. We brewed one of his beers at our brew pub. And then the fourth is what we brewed with Mike McDowell, and there's Chad and Randy in there, his assistant brewers. What home brewer has assistant brewers? And I can say that because like half of you know him, and half of you probably brewed the Janet's Brown Ale, which we're serving tonight. Or today. It's a great beer. I think this is the fourth time we've brewed it. Third or fourth, I can't remember. Three, they're telling me. I've actually never brewed it with him. Eric, our brew pub brewer, brews it with him, and it's been really cool because this great friendship has come to be between Mike and Chad and Randy and Eric, our brew pub brewer. They hang outside of the, you know, other days and when we're not just brewing the Janets. And Mike McDowell is like a rock star coming into our pub. Our staff loves him. So last year, Natalie bought me a little R&D system from More Beer, and that's the system there. I do more brewing on that than I do on our big systems now, and I really truly enjoy it more. So it's kind of come all full circle. We were home brewing at Corbell. I kind of skipped through that slide, but there was a slide up there of our little homebrew system we had at Corbell that the winery had bought from the beverage people in Santa Rosa. This is one of those cool systems from More Beer, 20-gallon system. And we're using it about every 3 weeks to develop more new beers. The Happy Hops that we're drinking today was originally developed on that system. The Erudition, which I think was pouring at the White Labs thing, Brewing Network thing the other night, was also the new versions of it were done on there. We have another kind of super saison called Defenestration that was created on the recipe, or on the homebrew system. The recipe was developed there. But I will throw in a disclaimer. Look at the bottom of the picture. There's a little wort chiller, and there's white tubes coming to it. That's actually 27 degree glycol, so I don't think I can call the homebrew system. It makes heat exchanging a snap. So... And then, you know, having cold boxes and barrel rooms at different temperatures, we can pretty much manipulate the temperature anywhere. But and I just want to finish that the my kind of the biggest project I've been working on with our little R&D pilot system is a collaboration we're going to be doing with Sierra Nevada next year. And for the we had already been brewing some beers that were Brett finished beers on the system. And along the way, Brian Grossman and I kind of concocted a plan to try to convince Ken Grossman to allow us to brew a Brettanomyces beer in Chico. And so he was on the fence on it, so I kept R&D brewing regardless. I knew he would bend eventually. So, or I should say... I knew Brian would bend him eventually. So for about the last 4 months, maybe 5 months, I'd been brewing these little R&D batches of what I hoped would be the beginnings of our collaboration. And so with that in mind, we finally convinced Ken to let us do our little project. And so we've got this Brettanomyces finished beer planned for next year, and it'll be the first time that, they've let Brett or anything funky into Chico. I could be the one that brings down Sierra Nevada. I was on this panel with Brian in Philly last week, and he goes, "Oh, we just got a few beers in him, got him a little buzzed, and he came around." But it's actually been a lot of fun and a lot of hard work trying to figure out, in all seriousness, how we're going to do this thing, you know, in an 800,000 barrel brewery without, you know, jacking up the entire operation. And for those of you that know Ken, you know he's a gadgets guy. He loves gadgets. So once we worked the gadget aspect into it and that we needed to build a gadget to get the Brett into the beer, he was on board like you can't believe. So we're spending a lot of time on that. We just handed the recipe over to Sierra Nevada. They're brewing the pilot batches. They brewed the first pilot batch, in fact, just earlier this week on Monday, and we'll do a couple more to really hone in the Brett on the beer. It's going to be a Brett finish beer, so not in the primary fermentation, in the finish. And it seems so simplistic, but it's amazing how complex these beers are. And then just to throw in the fact that, one, we don't want bottles exploding, so you got to get the beer super dry right to begin with. And then now you have this beer that's so dry, but you know, dry beer doesn't have as much mouthfeel and body, so try to get that aspect. And then most important, it's Sierra Nevada Brewery, so we don't want to screw that up at all. So anyways, that's all I have for you. I hope you enjoyed it. Cheers.
Well, thanks to Gary Glass and the American Homebrewers Association for letting me bring you the keynote, as they have for the past few years, and we greatly appreciate that. And also thanks to Vinny for the look back and all the great beers and inspiration. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com, or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits as well. And we still have a handful of our 2011 Brewers Logbooks. You can find them all on our website. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time, and you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com, and if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Fling Shot, Flying Monkey with Sound, and Emergency Fire Starter. Those two together would make an interesting combination. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support. And don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through associate links on basicbrewing.com, too. That's all until next week, everybody. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.